Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
This morning we offer something quite different. I am interviewing someone who has been on the show before, but not for a while, and I think can genuinely be called a veteran journalist in the most positive sense of the term. And I have invited Washington writer Barry D. Wood, who for two decades was chief economics correspondent of Voice of America News, reporting from 25 G7 or 8 or G20 summits. He's the Washington correspondent of RTHK Hong Kong Radio. And interestingly, from a South African point of view, some of his earliest reporting included covering key events in South Africa and Southern Africa, amongst them the Portuguese withdrawal from Mozambique and Angola, and the Soweto uprising in the mid-1970s. Just by the by, he is the author of the book Exploring New Europe, A Bicycle Journey, based on his travels by bicycle through 14 countries of the former Soviet bloc after the fall of Russian communism. And you can read more of his work at Econ Barry, E-C-O-N Barry, B-A-R-R-Y, oneword.com. And I'll put in the link for his YouTube video to watch and to enjoy. Barry, I think I'm in esteemed company of a person who has had the, perhaps let's call it, the great benefit of being inspired by leadership. And you say in the article that we printed in Daily Friend that in five decades of traveling and writing, you've met certain people who, through their humanity and ability to stay focused, conveyed a rare, clear sense of purpose. Barry, welcome. And is that the common theme in all the people we're about to discuss?
Thank you very much, Sarah. That's very kind. And yes, I feel very lucky to have spent 3 years initially in South Africa, and now to have gotten back a fair number of times since 2010.
Right. So you're probably better to write about us than we are. You have the perspective of both in and out.
Look, South Africa produces, Southern Africa produces such fine writers in the English language. I mean, it's amazing for a relatively small country.
So let's get on to your list. And first on your list is Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha, as I recall, if I remember my little financial knowledge at all. Just give us an idea for those who don't know, this being a sort of political program, in case anyone doesn't know, and this seems unlikely, who is Warren Buffett and what was your experience with him in interviewing him?
You know, it's ironic. I first learned of the importance of Warren Buffett, probably the world's most famous and most successful investor, in South Africa. And I learned that from Alec Hogg, who was at MoneyWeb at the time. And he's the one who really incentivized me to start attending the Warren Buffett annual meetings in Omaha, which I've done, what, 8 or 9 times now. Well, Warren Buffett is now 90 years old. He just turned 90 this past week. He is the chairman of Berkshire Hathaway, which is used to be a textile company. It's now a holding company for his, 40 or so companies that he controls or has large interests in. His vice chairman was Charles Munger, who is Los Angeles, also from Omaha. But Charlie died a year and a half ago, so no, Warren's on his own. Warren can't keep doing this forever, but he's still the chairman of Berkshire. Look, the connection to Washington and to me directly is that when Warren Buffett was growing up, he lived in Washington because his father was a Republican congressman. And in fact, he lived about 2 kilometers from where I live in Northwest Washington, D.C. Warren, of course, is a Democrat. Maybe it's because he had some difficulties with his father. But that house still stands. And when I interviewed Warren, we talked a lot about his time in Washington because essentially we lived in the same neighborhood.
You say, and I'd be interested to elaborate on this, that given his status. And I mean, as I say, I think there are probably very few people listening who don't know of him. He keeps his ego in check. He's modest and straightforward, and he exhibits an interest in the person he's talking to, not just himself, who is being questioned and spoken to by people like yourselves, by yourself. That strikes me as a very almost quaint aspect of personality that you don't associate with the investor community.
Yeah, that's true. That really is, Sarah, because Warren at one time within the last 10 years was the richest man in the world. Now he's what, number seven? He's given away 50% of his fortune, which numbers tens of billions of dollars. He is the author of this giving pledge, which calls on people Mosepi in South Africa have signed it. Dozens of people have signed it to promise to give away most of their fortune. I think my take would be what you see is what you get. This is a man who is not falsely modest. He's a modest guy. Now, that's not to say he doesn't have ego. He really does. I remember him saying when we met, well, by the time I was 10, I had read every book in the Omaha Public Library. Well, I doubt that's true, but it was something that stood out. And then, he came to Washington with his family. He does indeed have breakfast every day at McDonald's. I mean, and he lives in the same house that has been his for 50 years. And it's in Omaha, Nebraska, in the dead center of the United States. I mean, you can't fake this. So the other element I think that really stands out and makes him, in my perspective, a very inspiring leader, he takes the annual meetings of Berkshire Hathaway, which draw 30, 40,000 people to an arena in Omaha, as a teaching experience. And it's amazing, so many young Chinese come, both students in the States and all the way from China, to really sit at the feet of Warren Buffett and learn about investing. How do you value companies? How do you value economies? And I think Warren has said that's what he wants most to be remembered for.
I'd like to look at number two on your list, who I do not need to even consider having to introduce, and that's Ronald Reagan, President of the United States, Hollywood actor, and probably until fairly recently, I think history will look on his period as president with a lot more respect than perhaps he was given at the time of being the president in the early 80s. You describe him as having a twinkle in his eye, which was disarming, but he was serious and articulate. And I think he was grossly underestimated as being serious, despite the fact that you did get a sense that the man had a core of humor in his being. You covered his presidential campaign. Your impression?
Yeah, I agree with what you say. I think he is rising in stature as the years go by in judging his presidency. I remember myself, I opposed Reagan. I thought he was a dangerous man. Why? Because he was so old. What was that, 69? By today's standards, that's nothing. But I clearly was wrong, and I did call many people on the night of the 1980 election and say, don't vote for this man. He's going to get old in front of us. His hearing is bad, and I think I wasn't so much concerned about his politics, but I was concerned about his demeanor. I thought he was going to be an old man, which, again, sounds so quaint in the context of Joe Biden in 2024. But Reagan had something. I think he understood people very well. He could relate to people. He could disarm them with that twinkle in his eye, but he could also be pretty much a person of steel in terms of hardcore beliefs. And that won him friends and people who were adversaries nonetheless respected him. Ronald Reagan, you know, I remember when I was on this campaign, and the reason I was concerned about his hearing was he always would cup a hand over his ear and pretend not to hear a question that was shouted by a media person as he was about to get on or off his campaign plane. Well, probably that was a fake, because I think he wanted to collect his thoughts, but he was also deaf. Let's not dismiss that. Reagan stands out. I mean, he was comfortable with people. He could not be pushed around, but he was eager to, well, make deals, and he got along with lots of different people. I think that I regard the time that I spent, which is probably, what, 20, 30 minutes, in a bedroom at a fundraising event. His campaign stopped there, thus the campaign press plane stopped in South Carolina, as a rare opportunity to get to know a man of great significance.
You then go on to someone I think a lot of people knew of very much as a famous figure before he became a famous political figure, and that was Václav Havel, who was the president of what is now the Czech Republic, but was known before very much as an essayist, playwright, essentially a man of letters, and you refer to The Power of the Powerless, his 1978 essay, as describing a societal paradigm in which citizens were forced to live within a lie under the communist regime. It was very interesting because he became the last president of Czechoslovakia, the communist state, from the period 1989 to 1992, and then became the first president of the Czech Republic for the decade of 93 to 2003. There's something very romantic. I think many of us would assume, perhaps because he was a man of letters, that he would, being in a position of political power, would somehow diminish that in some way. What was your impression of the man?
Yeah, I agree with what you say. He was mildly famous worldwide because he was a dissident in Czechoslovakia. But, you know, he was elevated to the presidency. That wasn't something he wanted. There were, what, 500,000 people in Wenceslas Square demanding Havel to the castle, which is the seat of government in Czechoslovakia. He has a common man's perspective. This is a guy who, again, like Buffett, had no pretense. And as a result, he wrote his own speeches, for example. Isn't that amazing? I once got in trouble when I said, well, his speechwriter must be a pretty savvy guy. And my friend Jolien, who was a biographer of Havel, said, he writes all his own speeches. He wouldn't read anything someone else wrote. He had a way with words, and he had a way with enduring communism and yet not becoming broken or bitter. You know, he was in prison. His health suffered in prison. That's why he died relatively young. And yet he was not bitter. And he was a person who hated that system and yet did not come out and say it in an emotional manner. He rather would say, this was a system that diminished our humanity. He spoke in logic. He spoke as an essayist, as you say. And his plays, you know, they're always called absurdist plays. Sure, they're absurd in a sense, but that's a kind of Czech characteristic. These are people who are fun-loving and have a real strong sense of the ironic. And, you know, this is a small nation. There aren't very many Czechs in the world. Even today, the Czech Republic, or Czechia, as they now say, is less than 10 million people. So there you are. I know, I think Havel is unique. And when we lost him, I think we lost the ability to relate to leaders who were like us. You know, it's hard to take, well, even Joe Biden or Xi Jinping. It's hard to look at these guys as saying you're going to sit next to them in a pub and have a conversation. They're not that kind of person. But Havel was. He also had an endearing quality of stumbling in his words, not physically, but in his words. He would talk, but then make a mistake and start again. And it was, the man was magical. I think that's an apt description. He was a magical person.
And would you use the same description for the next person, who's Nelson Mandela, who I do not have to introduce?
No. This is a man who was deadly serious, it seemed to me. And he projected dignity. I don't think I've encountered many people like that. And I wish I'd had more time with Nelson Mandela. But this is a man who, 28 years in prison? Again, the lack of bitterness is remarkable and palpable. But he was not somebody who was going to make a joke, at least not when I was around. He was not a person who would listen and then have a repartee of something light. He was a great listener, but he was serious and he had work to do. And again, a very different kind of leader, but a true leader because of this projection of dignity. I don't know how that is accomplished, but he had it.
And then someone I think most people would not necessarily know of it, and that is Leszek Balcerowicz, a Polish economist, statesman, and professor at the Warsaw School of Economics. Now, he served as the chairman of the National Bank of Poland and twice as deputy prime minister of Poland. He had also been minister of finance. How is someone who, you know, seems, you know, to my ears, sort of otherworldly in the sort of academic finance, the hard stuff actually of leadership. We don't know much about him.
No, we
but
don't.
He's on your list,
and he's still working and still lecturing. I spent 2 days with him 2 years ago in Warsaw. He's very active politically. However, he's not seeking office. He's too old for that. He must be what? Certainly in his 70s. I think Leszek Balcerowicz is on my list for the following reason. He did something that had never been done. You know, it was a cliche 30 years ago to say there were hundreds, maybe thousands of books written about the transition from capitalism to communism. There wasn't a single book about the transition from communism to the market. So he had to take an economy that was really in a disastrous state. And he did this with Jeffrey Sachs, who's also on my list. And this was an ironic combination of a youthful American professor and a middle-aged Polish professor collaborating to come up with this Big Bang theory of how to build a market economy. I think, you know, the Washington city is the home of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. So there are literally thousands of economists here. This transition was beyond the purview, the thought pattern of any of these folks. And yet, Balcerowicz grabbed hold of something. When the first non-communist government came to power in Poland, I think it was in late 89, even before about the time the wall came down, they had inflation of 2 or 3,000%. The term hyperinflation, which is prices rising 50% per month, there were no goods to be had. One thing I've learned, just as a mere economics journalist, is In a communist society, the absence of goods is suppressed inflation. So if there's no soap, it's not on the shelves because a planner didn't organize enough or it didn't get distributed properly. That's suppressed inflation. The people looking for soap would have boosted the price way up, but prices don't change in a communist system. So in collaboration, and they took several weeks, even months, to put together a plan, the Balcerovich plan, to transform the economy. And I remember Jeff Sachs saying, look, once goods were produced, because prices were freed, all price controls were lifted, goods appeared on the shelves, but they were so expensive, no one could buy them. And it was said by Balcerovich and by Sachs, well, they could hope to buy them. They knew they were available. And if they believed in the system, if they believed in the transition that was underway, they could hope that they could someday purchase those products. And that's what worked. All the critics said this Balcerovich Big Bang theory was doomed to failure. And here was a guy who just kept seriously on the business. And in those years, he was a very serious guy, doing all the numbers like some economists do. And he just stayed with it. And he had political backing. He won the backing of Lech Wałęsa, other presidents, and could push ahead with his plan, even though the pain was very real. If you take money-losing state enterprises like steel, buses, whatever they were making, and you say, look, there's no more money, we're going to have to close or operate at a very modest pace and lay off hundreds or thousands of workers, hey, that's politically very damaging stuff. So you have to credit the politicians in Poland with staying with Balcerovich. And by 1992, 93, it was working. And Poland today, jump to 2024, is the most successful economy in Europe. It's amazing. So it worked. And I think that's what really makes Leszek Balcerovich a very, very important figure.
Just to touch briefly on Jeffrey Sachs, who you mentioned as working with Balcerovich, he's very much known as involvement with the United Nations and the idea of sustainable development and the sustainable development goals, and is, I guess, would be seen somewhat more a man of the left than we more commonly associate with economists.
Absolutely.
And so, but he's worked under with the UN Secretary Generals from Kofi Annan through Ban Ki-moon and Antonio Guterres. What was it about him on his own that made an impact, given the fact that he is seen as being a man more of the left?
Interesting. I think that it takes courage to be pilloried and criticized as much as Jeffrey Sachs is now. He is very much opposed to the Russia-Ukraine war. He thinks it should be ended immediately. He's not among those who blames Russia alone for this war. He said that the West, and he really has blamed the United States, crossed a Russian red line by wanting to bring Ukraine into NATO. He's also very critical, and he's Jewish himself, of the Israeli prime minister and of the war in Gaza. Very forthright. As a result, people have really attacked Jeffrey. And you're right. I think that not only is he a person of the left, but he's been consistently so. Now, how does that comport with being the advocate for building a capitalist economy in Poland in 1980? I think that was just an intellectual challenge that he rose to. It didn't take 24 hours in Warsaw in those years to know that that system that they had worked under for 40 years, enforced on them for 40 years, was a failure. The people didn't have proper clothing. They had jobs, but they didn't really work. You couldn't travel, all the things that we now know about a communist society. So I think that was the challenge, and it was an intellectual challenge, which he succeeded. But now that's all forgotten, because Jeffrey is now seen as just, well, pro-Russian, anti-Israeli. And I think that that's what caused me to circle back to Jeffrey, whom I've known since 1980, to say, wow, what gives you the strength to take these positions? And he argues persuasively and endlessly these positions in opposition to the standard critiques of journalists and academics. So, and by the way, he suffered a lot. He was at Harvard, very youngest, I think, tenured professor there, and then he went to Columbia. You know, there's always things that when people go after you, they can be brutal. And Jeffrey has suffered from that. So anyway, he's still at it. And I think he's a significant guy.
Well, because of time constraints, I won't go through all your lists, but I'd like to just mention the last, for me, the last person, because he's very current, is Neil Ferguson, the economics history academic. Partly because listening to him as a lay person is just always such a treat. He's clear, concepts. He gets you to understand concepts. He's enthusiastic. He's obviously prodigious. He's written a huge number of successful books, and he's very alluring, if I can put it that way. There's something very captivating about him, and including an almost childlike enthusiasm for the topics he loves. Can you just give us a little insight into him?
Yeah, I can. I think he's going to be well known over time for his biography of Henry Kissinger. And that's not to say he was sympathetic to Kissinger, but he got inside this rather significant person. And so these books are very important. And I think that he is unique among historians, Sarah, enabling people to understand the concept, not with historical perspective, of current events. So whether it's United States-China relations, whether it's United States-European relations, Neil can make that understandable. And I think that his capacity, he's also tireless. He works all the time. He's always on the media. You know, he's a self-promoter. He's probably got an investment fund as well. But nonetheless, when you're articulate and brilliant and have something to say about subjects people are interested in, you'll have a following.
I don't have the time for the rest. I really just, the last obvious question is there anyone out there that can lead? I feel like we're bereft of leadership.
Yeah, we are. I think the world is bereft of leadership. I used to, a year or two ago, Angela Merkel was a leader. But, you know, I think Germany is too constrained. I think there are lots of leaders, but we don't know who they are. It takes a lot of courage to get into the political ring. It's a brutal, brutal, dirty business. And I think of the Silicon Valley, which is really the United States' strength. And nobody is stepping forward from the Silicon Valley, but those are smart guys, mostly guys. Many of them, by the way, immigrants to the United States.
Yeah, I believe.
A few women, not many. But yeah, I think they're there, but they're hidden. And I think that's true right around the world, Sarah. There are lots of smart people, but very few are daring to step into the political arena.
Yeah. And who can blame them? Barry, thank you so much. And it's been a real pleasure just to venture into the positive and be reminded of the sort of brains and personalities and human and people filled with humanity that are out there that have made a difference. And presumably, even if there are not enough people in the political realm, there are people out there and coming up. We just have to hope that they'll have an impact on the people we we don't really see as
well,
as leadership.
Sarah, you know, look at South Africa. I mean, this transition into coalition politics, this is unprecedented. So good luck. The world needs South Africa to be successful.
So do we. So do we. Barry Wood, thank you very, very much.